91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Why do certain situations spark sudden violent behavior, even from people thought to be kind, gentle, and rational? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. This question was made real for neurobiologist and National Institutes of Health investigator Dr. Doug Fields. An amiable man, he reacted with instant violence against a street robber. Fields later felt that risking his life was unwise, so it prompted him to study the science behind reflexive outbursts. What are the triggers which cause them? Dr. R. Douglas Fields has written the book, Why We Snap, Understanding the Rage Circuit in Your Brain. Stay with us. Topical Currents up next. Here's the latest news. And we return. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman.
It's so common to hear sound bites from family, neighbors, or coworkers. They're perplexed after a bizarre act of sudden violence and agree, such a nice guy, quiet and helpful, so polite and caring.
These words may come after a terrible outburst of confrontation and fury. Today we learn more about the science and triggers of what causes us to lose it. We're with Dr. R. Douglas Fields.
He's a mild-mannered neuroscientist and senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health. He heads the neurocytology and physiology department.
Dr. Fields has also been a violent snap responder to a street thug gang. The experience led him to study why. He's written Why We Snap, Understanding the Rage Circuit in Your Brain.
Welcome, Dr. Fields.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, good to have you. Your book
sounds mild.
Really fascinating. Yeah. So we whet everybody's appetite. You were in Barcelona. Let's hear what happened.
Okay. I was about to give a talk on my research, neuroscience research, and my daughter was joining me. She was 17 years old, had just graduated from high school. That's unusual. I usually travel alone. And we had a little bit of time before I gave my lecture, so we thought, oh, we'll go see the Gaudi Cathedral. So we're coming up out of the metro, coming up the steps of the metro, and suddenly I felt this tug at my zippered pocket above my left knee. I slapped it like a mosquito, and my wallet was gone. Instantly, I reached back, clotheslined the robber, threw him to the ground, and put him in a headlock. And at that moment, this thought bubbles up to my consciousness. What the heck are you doing? You know, first, your listeners need to understand, you know, I'm not Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm 130 pounds, gray hair, wire-rimmed glasses. You know, this is no, I have no martial arts experience. I have no military experience, no street fighting. But this showed to me two things, that we're wired for violence. Suddenly, I knew how to do this. But secondly, it was very frightening to me because this happened so quick and it did not involve any conscious control. And that is what intrigued me and actually alarmed me, that something in our environment can suddenly cause us to carry out an aggressive action, risking our life and limb without any conscious thought. So I wanted to understand how that worked from a neuroscience perspective.
And your daughter's life. Yeah. It was also, would also risk your daughter's life.
Well, you see, that was a good point, is what I found out in terms of looking at this from the brain circuitry perspective, not a psychology perspective, but from the circuits in the brain that control behaviors, that it made a difference whether or not my daughter was there.
So was that...
And that, yeah.
I'm sorry. Is that quick reaction then that you had, is it similar to us removing our hand without thinking from a hot burner?
It is like that in the sense that clearly in some situations where you're confronted with a sudden threat, conscious deliberation is going to be too slow. And this is with the situation in Barcelona. But it's such a simple reflex to pull your hand away from a hot stove, whereas imagine what was going on in my mind in this Barcelona incident. It's not only why we snap, but how we snap. You know, that's a very complex, fluid situation. And what I realized is that we have a threat detection mechanism in our brain that is very sophisticated, constantly on the lookout for threats, crunching all this information, and then deciding a course of action and setting you on this course of action instantly. So that's one thing that is very fascinating. It has to be fast, like a hot stove, but it's such a complicated task.
So talk about why you think if your daughter hadn't been present, well, I guess that'll take us to the triggers, which we're going to get to, of course, the 9 triggers. But did you want to say more about that?
Well, sure. So the two features of snapping are, we discussed, they happen fast, faster than the speed of thought, and they're not deliberate. So that tells you, in terms of neural circuitry, that we're talking about a part of the brain that is not conscious. It's below the level of consciousness. And so we are, as human beings, all wired for violence. We have the capability of violence. We need it in terms of the evolutionary experience we had that developed our brain. We need to have self-defense. We need to protect our young. As a species, we're carnivores, so we need to kill animals. And it turns out that there is a region of the brain below consciousness where this violent aggression is unleashed. Circuitry controls this. This is called the hypothalamic attack area. The hypothalamus is the same part of the brain that controls other unconscious urges and functions like sexual behavior, thirst, hunger, those sorts of things. If you stick an electrode into the hypothalamic attack region of an animal and stimulate those neurons, the animal will instantly launch into an attack and kill a test animal put in a cage. We have that same circuitry. So then the question becomes, well, what triggers this attack area? And when you think about it, well, first of all, when you read the newspapers every day, it seems like almost anything can set off this snapping and sudden aggression. But in fact, that's not true. When you think about it in terms of biology or for an animal or a human being, engaging in a violent fight is risky, very risky. And you're not going to do that except in very specific circumstances. So new research using new methods has found that there are different circuits in the brain that will launch this attack behavior in response to different triggers. And this is new research using new methods that allow scientists to actually see which neurons and which circuits are being activated. So for example, if you're punched in the shoulder or you're attacked, you will instantly defend yourself aggressively. That's defensive aggression. But we also are very familiar with the mama bear response. If you get between a mother and her child and threaten that child, she will attack to defend her child. Those are two different circuits in the brain that feed into this hypothalamic attack area. And if you disable one of those circuits, like the one for the mama bear response, the mother will no longer protect her pups, but she will still have the defensive aggression. So that's the perspective from this book, is going inside, looking at the nuts and bolts of the brain, so to speak. How do different neural circuits activate this response? And it turns out there are only 9 triggers of this sudden anger and aggression.
Well, before we get to the 9 triggers, which you have that acronym LifeMorts for, and that makes them a little easier to remember, what does it mean that each of the triggers has its own circuit? What does that mean in lay terms?
Well, what that means is that a certain kind of provocation will activate this aggressive fighting behavior. And a different kind of provocation would activate this fighting behavior, but through a different circuit.
Okay.
From an ethical standpoint, though, Doctor, because of this snap circuit that you've described, are we responsible for our actions?
We're always responsible for our actions, and unless there is some psychological or neurological defect that prevents the brain from functioning normally, we're responsible for our actions. I also want to say that as the book is focused on this snapping behavior, really that's a starting point. You can't get the whole idea of the book across in just a title. The book involves other aspects of aggression And that's because it all feeds into this same circuitry in the brain, the neural circuitry of sudden, of threat detection. And an important point is that a huge part of our brain is devoted to threat detection. And this spans from the cerebral cortex, frontal lobes, to the amygdala in the middle of the brain, all the way to the hypothalamus. And so this hypothalamic attack region is under control of the cortex, can be inhibited or activated by it.
Go on. Were you going to add
something?
Well,
that's fine.
I was just wondering how does understanding what causes this snapping allow us to refrain from it? I mean, because
yes.
If it's unconscious, how can we ever refrain from it?
Well, the first part step in controlling anything is to understand the mechanism. So that's first of all. The reason that I came up with the life mort mnemonic is twofold. First of all, to get away from the scientific jargon. You know, many times the science is not that difficult. It's just an impenetrable jargon. And so rather than giving these circuits the names that are in the scientific literature, I gave them a mnemonic, life morts. It turns out there are nine of them, nine of these triggers of aggression. That's too many to remember. So I had to break it into a little word problem. So life and morts, life and deaths, allows you to remember them. The reason that that's important is that you can quickly identify when one of these triggers is activated, and if it's inappropriate, you can disarm that response. So the important point we haven't made yet is that we have this circuitry because we need it. And
right.
We do not call it snapping unless the outcome is inappropriate. Otherwise, we call it quick thinking or heroism. And it's the same circuitry in the brain. This is the circuitry that allows for athletes to make brilliant plays. So, you know, a large part of my book is interviewing people who rely on this circuitry. Secret Service agents, SEAL Team 6 members, race car drivers, where this circuitry it has to be performing at a high level. We only call it inappropriate, snapping, when it's inappropriate. So what we're talking about when we're talking about controlling it is preventing the misfires.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a short break. It's so interesting, but we're going to come back. We're going to find out what the triggers are. And we're speaking with neurobiologist Dr. R. Douglas Fields about his book, Why We Snap, Understanding the Rage Circuit in Your Brain. We'll be right back.
And we return 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman on this very wet Monday afternoon. We hope if you're behind the wheel that you're extra careful today.
Dr. Fields, I want to go back to Barcelona just so we can complete one thing. First of all, did you get your wallet back?
I did get my wallet back, but you know it was a very risky thing, and that's not the right thing to do. You should give your wallet to a robber. And I also didn't realize it was part of a whole gang. So it turned out that this gang chased my daughter and me through Barcelona for the next 2 hours. So it was a very harrowing experience.
Oh, yeah, really. I just, you know, I had to ask myself when I was reading it, why didn't you, like, reach out to the police or something instead of just trying to get away from them for 2 hours?
Well, I didn't. We couldn't find any police. We tried. It. You know, when you read the description in the book, it sounds like a spy scene from a
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, it does.
But it was reality. We were running for our lives and using every trick we could to outwit them. You asked about controlling this. One of the people I interviewed was a SEAL Team 6 member, and I told him about this episode, and he said, "Yeah, I never would have done that." You know, and here's a guy who's
trained to do it.
He could take out somebody with a judo chop to the throat while ordering two beers with his other hand, right? And he wouldn't do it. But he trains not to do it. So you can control the circuitry. That's one of the interesting things.
Getting back to these nine triggers for snapping, so to speak, it seems that we vary also on what we protect the most, whether it's your mate, a child, your money, your space.
Right. Well, that's what's so interesting to me is we hear a lot about, crime that's caused in shootings caused by mentally ill individuals or criminals. But when I look at the paper, every day it's filled with this sort of thing. It's filled with so-called normal people just snapping in a barroom brawl or a domestic dispute. And we just say they snapped, and then that really doesn't explain anything. But in fact, when you look at it, it isn't just a wide range of situations that will cause this. Very specific triggers will cause them. And we see this
on
the road all the
time.
Did
you, Doctor, see the story the last few days of this Miami female doctor that attacked the Uber driver here and went on Good Morning America and apologized for snapping and doing that? But also alcohol was involved there. How does that play?
Well, alcohol impairs the controls on this circuitry, for sure, and drugs as well. But, yeah, that's always the case. But it's the same thing a hero says, right? After they aggressively intervene, risk their life, and then they say, oh, I didn't think. But, yeah, road rage, I didn't hear about that one, but I did hear about the Thanksgiving road rage in Miami.
Right.
Where, two guys got into a fight, and one of them pulled a gun and shot the other one. I mean, how do you explain this? Where you're going down the road and suddenly two guys get enraged, pursue each other, intent on a fight. So what that is a misfire. And it's a misfire of circuitry designed to protect your life in a very different situation. You know, the brain we have now is the brain we had 100,000 years ago when we lived on the open plains of Africa. And now the brain is coping with an environment which is totally alien. And it turns out that driving on the road hits almost all nine of these triggers of rage because the brain never encountered the situations that we now experience. Probably, I probably should try to explain the triggers.
Yeah, let's go over the triggers. Let's go over each of them. I mean, just first, tell us what they are.
Right. So the mnemonic life morts, again, so that you can recognize them. And we've talked to L is for life or limb. That's the defensive aggression. Life or limb, if you're attacked, you will fight back. I is insult. Cause of a lot of aggression in barroom brawls and duels of the past. Need to explain why you get angry with an insult. We're social animals, and your resources, your opportunities depend on your status within the social group. And like other mammals and many other animals that aren't even mammals, your status, your rank in the social group is determined by aggressive interaction. Think of headbutting in sheep. Humans have language, and that substitutes for headbutting. So that's why you're angry if someone insults you. It is threatening your dominance, which in a biological sense really does affect your survival. Okay, took too long on that one. F is family. That is the mama bear response, protecting your young. And E is environment. Territorial animals will use violence and aggression to protect their territory. Human beings are fiercely territorial, right? Trespassers will be shot, or somebody come into your home, you can use aggression, will resort to aggression if you have to. So E trigger. M is for mate. In the animal world, violence and aggression is used to acquire and to defend mates, and that's still a very large part of the aggression that we see today. O is for order in society. As I said, we're a social animal. We're totally dependent on our society for our survival. If you're out in the Everglades 24 hours by yourself, they're going to send in the helicopters and try and find you because you're going to die. So in order to maintain a social structure, animals use violence. And we use violence today in the same way. It's through the legal system. But if somebody doesn't stop at a red light or pay their taxes, we will take away through the legal system, take away their resources, put them incarcerate them. Those are all forms of violence. But we need to realize, again, these are double-edged swords. This is what allows us to form cohesive groups.
Right.
So then R is resources. You know, your friendly pet will snap instantly if another pet threatens its dog dish. And so in human beings, food, translates into money. So we will, when our resources, our money, our valuables are stolen, that was the initial trigger for me in Barcelona.
Was
we
resources?
Will respond. Was resources. Okay. Yeah, my wallet was stolen.
Okay.
But it was also the F trigger. It was because my daughter was right. totally dependent on me. And if she hadn't been there, I might not have done that. There were also some other situations that I explained by the time you get to the end of the book why I did that. And the last one, stopped. Any animal who is restrained will become angry and resort to aggression to get free from the restraint. It'll gnaw its arm off to get out of a trap. Aaron Ralston, that backpacker, he cut his own arm off in the same situation. So if you feel restrained, if you are restrained, you will then act aggressively to break that restraint. But what happens on the road, a lot of these triggers get hit inappropriately by situations that don't exist. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you. What goes into it? It sounds like a lot of them go into road rage. Which one? I mean, is it mostly the stopped?
The stopped is certainly one, but a lot of them do. So let's take stopped. You know, suddenly they're doing construction, everything stops, and you're held up in traffic. And you're suddenly feeling this overwhelming rage, anger. Well, why? Human beings have all kinds of emotions, all kinds of behaviors we could have. You could get sleepy. You could get bored. But no, we want to go throttle somebody. The reason is you've hit that stopped trigger. That trigger knows about being grabbed by the ankles or quicksand, but it knows nothing about being stuck in traffic. Mm-hmm. So it's the same response. So it's a misfire, and this is how it can be helpful. So if you're on the road, you suddenly feel this anger rising, ask yourself why, and is it one of these triggers? If it's one of these triggers that is causing this rage, you'll know two things. You've engaged circuitry in the brain designed to release violence. Number two, if it's inappropriate, that being violence, then it will instantly disarm. Much better than trying to calm yourself down. You try to tell somebody who's angry to calm down, it doesn't work very well, even when you tell yourself that.
Right.
But if it's a misfire, that anger goes away. Another good example on the road would be somebody cuts in front of you and you're overwhelmed with anger. Why?
Is that insult?
No, not necessarily. I don't think so. I think that's the E trigger. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that we will defend our environment. And we impulsively and rapidly will defend our environment if there's an intruder into our environment. We perceive the space around our car as our environment. But that's an illusion. Whether the guy is on your front bumper or your back bumper, it makes a couple of seconds difference for the purpose of the activity, right? It makes no sense. If you're running over territory, over ground, we don't have that response. People cut in front of us and we don't get angry. We laugh or even. But we have this illusion because the brain driving didn't exist when these circuits evolved, that somebody has intruded into your territory and now instantly this hypothalamic attack region and anger wells up. Now that's an example. So if somebody cuts in front of you and you go, oh, the E trigger, then the anger just goes away. You disarm the response.
What trigger would influence one to say, lash out at something inanimate? They're trying to put together something from IKEA
or computer
and get so frustrated and angry that they break it.
Yeah. That's very often the insult trigger. And and that we see that in sports. You know, sports is a great place to see these triggers work positively and negatively. But as we talked about, your status in dominance, the status in society is very important to your survival and even your own perception of that. So if you find that, you're not meeting your expectations, then it's a self-insult. You feel inadequate, you feel like you're failing, and that activates this anger.
How does age affect the circuitry and our ability to control it?
It's a good question. So this circuitry is under control of the prefrontal cortex. And teenagers don't have the prefrontal cortex developed. It's not developed until the early 20s. And this is one of the reasons that we don't hold them legally responsible.
Right.
Now, also in old age, there are changes in the brain with age and also age-related neurological conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. There's some cortical thinning. All of these reduce the ability of the prefrontal cortex to suppress the brain's threat detection system. So So in aging, it can be inhibited, just like drugs will affect that.
You know, that's interesting that you say that. It's so fascinating because I know, you know, for years now when I've been driving and I see these really old people behind the wheel get really angry, you know, about, you know, do the road rage thing and, you know, do all sorts of gesturing and stuff. And I'm thinking, God, they're so old. Haven't they learned not to do that? But it's just the opposite. Because they are old, you're saying they don't have the same control over the circuitry.
Yes, it's interesting that with aging, you lose this ability to control. Huh. But let me make the point. The studies have been done that if you exclude from those studies elderly people with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or other age-related problems, they actually have less snapping or less impulsive behavior. But
wait, who has the less impulsive behavior?
Elderly people.
Right. Okay.
So the problem is that as a consequence of age-related neurological conditions, you can acquire these conditions, you are at risk for these conditions that will affect the circuitry. And so that's why you see more snapping in general in the elderly. But if you exclude those people who don't have, they're spared from things like dementia, then we don't see that in fact. So. It's okay. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. We're speaking with neurobiologist Dr. R. Douglas Fields. He's a senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health in, of course, Bethesda, Maryland. He's also chief of the Nervous System Development and Plasticity section of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. A short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. R. Douglas Fields. If you'd like to join in the conversation, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, or email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Dr. Fields, how about relating this the SNAP business with Sandy Hook and those kind of planned murders, mass murders?
Right. I'd like to make, that's a good question, and, you know, the book is not about pathology. It's not about people who have broken minds, the sickening shooting in Sandy Hook, that's different. This is about a normal behavior. The whole book is about normal behavior. But, and we all have this circuitry for snapping, even if it's a verbal snap, you know, the consequences of that can be career changing or break a relationship. And also these violent outbursts. So snapping's important. But the same circuitry, when I get into the circuitry in the book, is activated in all kinds of human aggression because, again, we're not going to get into a fight except in very specific circumstances. So, for example, the Oregon Wildlife Refuge right now, where, you know, Aaron Bundy and Lavoie Finicum was just shot, you look at that situation and my understanding is that those people don't have a criminal record, and they're not mentally ill. So, if we go on that assumption, how do you explain suddenly people arming themselves and bent on a fight? And if you look at that situation, it is just a nest of these triggers of rage. Several of them are being activated in that situation at once. So. I did want to point out one thing, Bonnie, when you were asking me about the road rage that is important, and that's chronic stress. So one thing is to understand what these triggers mm-hmm. are, but another part of this whole mechanism in the brain, which makes it so amazing, is that the threshold on pulling these triggers changes, and, you know, it has to. If you're in a threatening environment, well, you want to put your brain's threat detection mechanism on high alert. Makes sense if you're in a bad neighborhood or in a war. It can be that people are under chronic stress. Usually when you hear about somebody snapping violently in the paper, you don't get the backstory. There's usually some underlying chronic stress, and that makes these triggers more likely to misfire. So this is also a problem in the elderly who may have chronic stress due to health-related issues. You know, every phase of life has its issues, adolescence and middle age, everything. But chronic stress can result in more of this misfiring. But that's not a pathology. Again, this is the mechanism important mechanism of the brain, and I discuss how that works, the neurotransmitters, and how we constantly adjust this the threshold, because it is so much more complicated than pulling your hand off a hot stove.
So, in other words, if you're stuck in rush hour traffic every single day, every morning, every evening, then the stress of being in that situation day after day is going to be much worse than if you just happen to once, you know, get caught. I mean, the rage circuit, I'm saying.
Right. Well, Bonnie, so the thing is, what I like to emphasize is your brain's threat detection mechanism is operating unconsciously for two reasons. Conscious thought's too slow. And secondly, your conscious mind couldn't handle it. It'd be sensory overload. So this circuitry is amazing. All of your senses, all of them, go into your threat detection mechanism before they go to the cerebral cortex, which is where our consciousness arises. So it goes to your threat detection mechanism before you even are aware of it. That's how you can dodge a ball that comes flying at you, jump out of the way and go, what was that? Well, you actually never saw the ball. It just went to your threat detection mechanism like a motion detector and a security system and said, that shouldn't be here, jump. So your threat detection mechanism in your brain is taking in all your sensory input around you, situational information, and all the internal situational information. Are you hungry? Are you sick? All these things. Crunching all this information that your conscious brain simply couldn't handle and putting you on a course of action. So what is chronic stress? First of all, your unconscious brain can't communicate rationally, can't use language, doesn't have that. It has emotion. So when you say, oh, I'm frustrated, or I was angry, or jealous, what you're really talking about is your unconscious brain reaching a conclusion and trying to communicate to your conscious brain the situation. So when you feel under chronic stress, what that is your threat detection mechanism in your brain taking in all this information, concluding you're in danger, whatever, you know, it could be health-related, it could be business-related, financial, whatever, you're in danger, communicates that the only way it can with this emotion that we call chronic stress. So if you can recognize that when you're in chronic stress, your triggers are going to be more likely to fire. If you can't reduce the chronic stress, you can take measures to reduce chronic stress, but a lot of those things may not be in your control, like health. But just being aware that you need to be extra careful. Some of them are in control. Like, you know, if you're late for work, you're going to be stressed. You can avoid that.
Right.
But knowing that you're under chronic stress, when you get behind the wheel, you better realize you are at danger for a misfire.
Well, let me just if we could just sum this up. You're saying that the unconscious threat mechanism, the unconscious threat detection mechanism controls the emotions, or the emotions control the unconscious threat detection mechanism.
Well, it's a good point, because we're always so used to saying, oh, I did it because I was frustrated. No, that's the noise of the engine. That's not the mechanism, that being the emotion. So I'll give you an example. You walk out of your house in the morning, you go through your pockets, you go, I'm forgetting something. You go down the list, no, I got it all. You get in the car, you go a mile down the road and you go, oh, my cell phone, I left my cell phone.
Right.
That's your unconscious mind knew that you left your cell phone, and it's been screaming at your conscious mind, and the only way it can with that feeling, that you know, we all recognize that feeling that you've left something, trying to tell your conscious mind that you have left your cell phone. As soon as it registers, that feeling, that queasy feeling, that angst goes away, because that part of the brain has fulfilled its function, it reached your cortex. The emotions are caused by, a result of, the workings of the unconscious mind communicating and these multicolored emotions that we have, what's going on.
Wow. Dr. Field, speaking of the unconscious mind, we've always heard for years that we possess this older sort of lizard brain within our cranium, and that's makes us prone to more basic behaviors. You say that's really a fallacy.
Well, that's a really outdated idea, and really it was only it was a non-scientific idea. Scientists didn't really use that terminology. This idea that there's some lizard in our brain that makes us do beastly things, that's just overly simplistic. But what the new research coming out from very new techniques, for example, you can have a mother put a mother in a situation where she protects her pups when there's an intruder and fights the intruder, then you can look in the brain with new methods, fiber optic cable, and look in and see which neurons are firing. We now see, using these much more sophisticated techniques, what an intricate threat detection mechanism our brain has. So yeah, the lizard brain idea is gone.
I'd like you to address the differences between males and females in the circuitry, the threat detection circuitry, and our responses to it.
Bonnie, that's such an interesting area. That's one of the things that I was really interested in. They're very different. So first of all, the biggest factor in violence and aggression, by far, is sex. 90% of all the prisoners in jail for violent crimes are men. Males are aggressive. But at the same time, 90% of the people who have been awarded medals for heroism by the Carnegie Foundation
are men.
Men. And a quarter of those guys died, gave up their life in a snap to save somebody else, often a stranger, to come to somebody else's aid when they were in danger. So, a double-edged sword. But the world that men and women inhabit is very different. Again, talking about the, not modern world, we have a lot of different, the world today is very different, but the pressures that form the human brain over the last 100,000 years very much depend on the different roles of males and females, okay? So if you were a guy 100,000 years ago, your job was to go out and kill a woolly mammoth with a sharp stick. You know, that takes working together, takes a little bit of fortitude, risk, aggressiveness. So these result in differences in the wiring in the male and female brains. I'll give you another example. Walking around the street at night, as a guy, I never worry about being sexually assaulted. And the sad fact is, I'm a father of two girls and one boy, but a woman can never not have that concern, that right. reality in the back of her mind. That has made women and men have very different threat detection mechanisms in the brain and also different responses to threat. So women don't engage. It makes no sense for a woman to get into a fight with a guy who weighs 100 pounds more than her. That doesn't happen. Women tend to have more indirect aggression, gossip, sabotage, poisoning, ganging up, those kind of things. But one of the things that is really, I'll give you one example, if I can, that became very apparent to me. When we were in Barcelona, we were being chased by these bad guys. There were six members of this gang. And I quickly became apparent that my daughter was much better at picking out these bad guys in the crowd than I was. She would pick them out and point them out to me as they're closing in on us. And I quickly just gave up to that and let her find these guys because she's picking them out. And I'm thinking of big picture things. What am I going to do when I get these guys and big strategy? So I later talked to Larry Cahill, who's done some research on the differences between male and female brains under stress. And it turns out that male and female brains respond differently in times of stress. So females shift to use the left hemisphere, and males shift to use the right hemisphere. We can see this with electrophysiological measures and brain imaging. What that means is the left hemisphere looks at the detail, very analytical. So the woman is down there, like Kelly was, looking at all these details and seeing it every. And the right hemisphere generalizes. And, of course, forming generalizations and looking at detail are opposites. You can't do both.
Right.
But what a dynamic, powerful threat detection mechanism we had when I had the female brain looking at the details and the male brain looking at these big picture.
Yeah.
During normal times, when you're not in stress, the human brain switches between the left and right hemisphere all the time. I'm talking about in this just time of threat. So it's very, very interesting.
Well, when we get back, I was thinking about men and women in the military when they're under threat. Anyway, we'll get to that. We're speaking with neurobiologist Dr. R. Douglas Fields about his book, Why We Snap, Understanding the Rage Circuit in Your Brain. We'll be right back, our last break.
Hey,
And we're back. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. 49 minutes past 1 o'clock, we resume our conversation with Dr. R. Douglas Fields. He's joining us from NPR in Washington. We're talking about his book, Why We Snap, Understanding the Rage Circuit in Your Brain.
So, Dr. Fields, talking about the differences between men and women, their response to stress or to the threat detection, and I was thinking, how does it affect men and women differently in the military, and who would it be more of a hindrance to?
Well, the military works, you know, I interviewed a lot of SEAL Team 6 members and people in the military, as well as Secret Service agents and elite athletes. They refine this threat detection mechanism. They trust their gut. They learn to trust their gut. They learn to control this. And so both men and women do. So I don't know what particular, I don't know how to answer your question, but I would like to make one point. You know, one thing that's going on now is holding men and women to the same standards to, you know, and by the way, 20% of the Israeli army is female. So women can perform in combat, especially with just as well as a man, especially with technology. You know, it doesn't matter who's got the hand, who's driving flying an F-16, if it's a male or a female, really doesn't matter because of the technological difference. So one thing I would say is that the differences between males and females in terms of threat detection, each one has its own advantage. And it may be, and I'm sure it's true, that in many situations in the military, maybe threat assessment or something, the female threat detection mechanism may have advantages that the male doesn't. So, you know, rather than trying to pretend that male and female bodies and brains are the same, which they clearly are not, realizing that each of them have unique advantages, and things like bravery are not different between the sexes. We really, I think if we don't fully utilize both sexes in the military, we're losing a great potential.
So tell us a little more about how these 9 triggers can also spur really superhuman efforts. You picture the mother lifting the rear end of a car off a child or something.
Right. Well, you know, again, it's the same thing. It has to be fast. You know, example is Spencer Stone on the airman who was on that train to Paris, and he jumps up with his partners and takes down this terrorist who's armed with an AK-47 and a knife. And faster than an automatic rifle, these guys take that guy out. So that's an example of that working. By the way, I think I left out the T when I described life morts, which stands for tribe. And this makes me think of that. Human beings form tribes for mutual defense and cooperation, and we will use violence to protect our tribe. And that's remarkable. You know, you can go shirts and skins in a ball game, and suddenly in the fastest paced game possible, we can operate as 2 teams. So violence is used to protect the tribe or your nation, or the, you know, it's also again, the double-edged sword. This is the reason for racism. This is the reason for gangs. But it's also what allows us to form nations, cooperative groups, to decide we're going to go to the moon and do it.
But can so, it also be cause war?
Well, definitely it causes war. So that very often the cause of war, racism, gangs, cause of war, seeing people as different, different religions. There is circuitry in our brain that within 170 milliseconds of seeing somebody categorizes that person into us versus them. Mm. You're either in my group or you're in an out group. This is unconscious and it's instant. And it's all based on superficial things like race and sex and the situation. But this is the key to forming tribes. So Spencer Stone didn't attack that guy alone. Spontaneously, his buddies and others, you know, a British IT consultant, a complete stranger, joined in the team because that guy was them. And think how quickly that happened. There's no thought involved. This is not a rationalization. This is just the key to human success over other animals is that we form these cooperative, tightly knit societies, and we will engage violently to protect our tribe. And that's what Spencer Stone was doing.
Does the tribal trigger have any relationship, say, with mob behavior and looting or lynching and burning down buildings?
I think, you know, it obviously does. And during the Baltimore riots, I went to the riots to, I went to that CVS store to see that, what was going on. And that was clearly a case of the tribe trigger causing that violence. And at first, this was the Freddie Young, who was it? The person who had his neck broken, Freddie Gray.
Freddie Gray, yeah.
Broken while being transported to the police station. When that first came out, there was a riot, and the first thought was it was racial, and that's the way it was portrayed. But I didn't get the feeling that it was when I went there looking at it myself. I saw it as us versus them. It was the criminal versus the cops, or kind of thing. And that's turned out to be what it was, because you know, the African-American policemen were involved in that. So it wasn't fundamentally racial, but it is us versus them. And that whole situation derives from the discrimination that people in that neighborhood live with, where they have high unemployment, they have high crime, drugs, no opportunity. And that fundamentally is the negative aspect of the T-trigger, where they those people are subject to discrimination because they're them, and then they're regarded differently. You know, one of the things that I got so excited about reading this book, doing this research on the book, because the neuroscience is so interesting. But then I should have realized that there is a lot of terrible violence that I had to come to grips with, and things like torture. How do you come to grips with torture? There have been studies that show that part of the brain will activate when watching somebody experience pain. That if you put a sharp needle into the cheek, this will light up this part of the brain, but only if the person is the same race as you.
Really? You know, I'm thinking that this book is so important for so many reasons. Because it could prevent a lot of the violence in our culture. What did you hope to accomplish? Do you want us to become, you know, more aware of these triggers, and so that we can learn how to control them or rein them in? Because they're clearly double-edged swords, all of them.
That's my whole hope. That's why I did it. It was interesting, you know, to get into the neuroscience of it all, because it's really fascinating, unconscious mind working. But fundamentally, it was looking at the papers and seeing all this violence and saying, oh, the guy snapped and we don't do anything about it. I want people to understand you can do things about it. I also interview nonviolent people like the Janes and Quakers. Mm-hmm. And I want, for example, teenagers to know the life morts. They need to know why they're angry when somebody disrespects them on Facebook. They already know they shouldn't be angry. And yeah, anger management is good, but I want them, everyone, to know these life morts, because we need to prevent the misfires. And in modern world, we have more opportunities for these triggers to get tripped. In addition, we have chronic stress and crowding and bombardment of the senses. So we're seeing more and more of this. And just to make that very clear, there's one chapter in the book where someone I know lost his life in a rage incident. The trial's not over, so we have to have presumption of, you know, innocence until the trial finishes. But it was this thing. These two people were a mentor, 20-year friends, and in an instant of violence, one of them was killed, either in self-defense or in outright murder. And I knew these people. And I read this every day in the paper, and something needs to be done about this. And one of the things we read, oh, what's the motive? You know, we have these school shootings and whatever, workplace shootings. And very often, it's not a motive. It doesn't make any sense, because it doesn't come from that part of the brain. It comes from the emotional part of the brain. Somebody's feeling threatened or impeded or something. Yeah.
Well, we do have to go, but we really appreciate neurobiologist Dr. R. Douglas Fields, senior investigator at the National Institutes of Health. And he's written Why We Snap, Understanding the Rage Circuit in Your Brain. And we thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book, Doctor.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I also want to make clear that I'm not representing the NIH in writing this book.
Okay.
I work there and I run a lab, but this is separate from that.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction from online, producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow on Topical Currents, we hear from writer Greg Easterbrook, who's written The Game Is Not Over, in defense of football. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.